I have done a ton of podcasts about persuasion, negotiation, influence, and all the things related to it. I've talked with everybody from Robert Cialdini and his book Influence, Bill Battide, The Power Bible, on and on. And I've written a lot about negotiation and persuasion. I wrote about this in Choose Yourself, Reinvent Yourself, Skip the Line. But this book by Jonah Berger, Magic Words, and the subtitle is What to Say to Get Your Way. This book talks very specifically about what language to use and why and when and what context, whether it's how to say no, how to ask for advice, how to make content go viral, convince someone to use your services versus someone else's services, how to make yourself more creative. It's just a great book about how important even small nuances in language can be. These small nuances in language can make big impact in your life. And by coincidence, I've used some of these techniques in my own life, and I can attest that they're true. Jonah's got all the research, all the examples, so many tools, like for instance, questions to ask if you want to socially get along with people much faster, or when should you use can't when saying no versus don't. In any case, we talk about a lot of these techniques. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Let me know if you like this, share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast. It really helps me a lot when you do that. So I hope people do that and have fun.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Jonah, I don't know if you remember, you were on the podcast way back. I think it was like 2015 or 2016 for Contagious.
Yes.
How are things going?
Good. And I think you also were nice enough to have me back a couple years ago for The Catalyst. So we've talked a few times before, and I remember it as always far-ranging and fun. So I'm looking forward to the same thing today.
Excellent. Well, I really enjoyed Magic Words. You know, all your books are sort of about persuasion, viral content, basically how to use language in a weird way to manipulate people. And I don't mean that in a negative way. You want people to use language effectively, like how language is intended to be used. But what really drives your interest in this? Like, do you wish you were secretly a YouTube star with viral content all over the place? Or like, what's underneath the surface here? Are you trying to crack the code?
Yeah, I mean, so what I find interesting to me is that a lot of this is really math. Right? And not math exactly, but like, think about reading a book. Think about watching a movie. Think about reading a piece of content online. Think about watching a presentation. We often have reactions to those things. Man, I love this movie. Oh my God, this presentation was terrible. I enjoyed this part of the book, but not this other part of the book. Why? Why are we having those reactions? And how, by understanding the way language works, can we begin to parse this in some sense? You know, you were nice enough to interview me a number of years ago for my first book, Contagious. And that was my first popular press book. It changed my life to some degree. I was only an academic and got an opportunity because of that book to work with all sorts of companies and organizations. But it kept making me wonder, you know, what about some of these popular press books? Like, why do they do better? If we were to engineer a story, right? When you're writing a book or when you're making a presentation or when you're doing an interview like this, there are a billion different ways you could tell the same story. Do some ways of telling that story make it better or worse? And why? You know, if you look at comedians, they often talk about, or you look at them, they often hone jokes. They don't just sort of, you know, do a joke once and do it the same way. They do it different ways while they're getting ready for, initially doing a tour or whatever it might be, to see how it hits differently. And I've always wondered, you know, could we, by parsing language, could we begin to understand some of this? Could we put some math and some structure and some logic to why certain content is more impactful than others?
Well, and I'm going to skip around the book. You just brought up how your first book opened the doorway for you to start working with organizations, you know, for instance, to help them make their own content more viral or figure out how people were reacting to their content. And, you know, about two-thirds of the way through the book, you described this one scenario where you found that when companies use the word you instead of an abstract third person, they got more response. For instance, you know, here's five ways to lose weight might not work as well as here's five ways,
you can lose weight. Yeah.
Now, I was curious about that. So first off, with all of this stuff, you describe various experiments. So what do the experiments say about you versus the passive? And then I have a follow-up question to that, because you also suggest always have follow-up questions.
So stepping back for a second, I agree with almost everything you said, except one small piece, which is this isn't just selling people on stuff they don't need or convincing people to do things they don't want to do. You know, if a nonprofit uses these tools to get more attention for a cause about saving the environment or, you know, doing something good for the world, if using language helps us achieve our goals, you know, it's not that these tools or approaches are either good or bad. They're just tools or approaches, right? It's how we use them.
I 100% agree. And you know, I didn't bring it up that aspect because I understand that if you have a message you want to get across, there's no sense in using language that doesn't get that message across effectively.
Yeah.
And you know, Alain de Botton has this video, you know, why nice guys need to use Machiavellian techniques, because the evil guys are already using the most manipulative techniques possible. So more important than ever for the nice guys to get their message out, but you still have to use effective techniques in influence and persuasion and so on.
Yeah. So let's talk about you in the company world, and we can also talk about it in sort of the more personal world. So, you know, first of all, I did a big analysis. Somebody else did some analysis of social media pages, and I did a big analysis of help pages. So the page you go to, for example, when you have a problem with your computer or one of your electronic devices for a big consumer electronics company. And what we found is on social media, when you use you, your content gets more engagement. So rather than saying, this is a great book, saying, this is a great book for you, you'll love this tip versus here's a great tip. The word you, in some sense, is like a little bit of a spotlight. It's a little bit like a stop sign. You know, I'm scrolling.
Even though, sorry to interrupt, but even though like when you say, here's a great tip, the implied next two words are for you.
Yes. Oh, even if implicitly, and I like what you said there, implicitly it is for you, but it doesn't explicitly have it out there. And by the way, you know, you could say, well, on social media, doesn't it feel hokey to say you? And like any other approach, if it's used in a bad way, it won't be effective. But you can be a little bit like a stoplight or a stop sign, right? I'm scrolling on social. There's all these different things there. Well, something says you, well, it's speaking to me. I better pay a little bit more attention. My sort of ears pick up and I'm more likely to pay attention to it. And so in a variety of different contexts, there's a bunch of different data that suggests that you can kind of involve us in the message more, gain our attention, and make us want to look at something. And so that was neat. I said, okay, well, great. You is really useful. But then I did this analysis of customer service, basically help pages. So, you know, I have to do something with my computer or my phone's not working. I go to their website and they have a bunch of pages. And looked at the word you there. And if you is good, right, you should be helpful in both contexts. But that's actually not what I found. In fact, in that context, you was bad. If there was more words like you on help pages, people actually found the pages less helpful, just kind of the opposite of the benefit of you on social. And so in thinking about why, there's some other nice research that shows that, well, you in some sense can be a little bit blameworthy. If it says, you know, you need to reboot your computer, you should do this. It says, well, hold on, why is it my job to do this? It puts the onus or the agency on me to solve the problem. It might make me feel attacked, like you were suggesting I caused the problem, or somehow like I'm the one that needs to do the work to fix it rather than it being the device's fault. And so
I wonder if I may offer my own.
Yeah.
I wonder if maybe saying you in that context implies less leadership from the company. Meaning, you know, if let's say I'm going to Apple's help desk, my iPhone doesn't turn on for some reason, and it says, you know, maybe the question in the FAQ is written like, your iPhone doesn't turn on, here's what you should do. That's somehow less authoritative than, here's what to do when the iPhone doesn't turn on. Like, then it's very much like coming down from God on the Ten Commandments, like, this is what to do. And so it's less personal and more authoritative.
I think that's certainly a way to think about it. I think what you also kind of said is, rather than it being, you know, when your iPhone won't start, when the iPhone won't start, it sort of suggests that the fault is more the iPhone, right? Was your iPhone won't fault, it suggests, well, maybe somehow your something you did, it's specific to you rather than to the device in general. If you had to say sort of who's the locus of fault, using you could put it more on you, the user, rather than the company or the device, which not surprisingly makes people go, well, what do you mean? This device isn't working. It's not my fault. It's your fault. You know, how dare you tell me that somehow it has to do with me? And so, you know, you by itself is neither good nor bad. It has differing effects on depending on the situation. And you can even see, so now moving sort of more to the personal life context, and you've probably seen this in your own life, but whether at work or in your personal lives, you know, you has this sort of way of kind of feeling accusatory if it's not used carefully. So, you know, in a work context, saying something like, you know, did you file that thing we talked about? Did you take care of this? In a personal context, you know, did you walk the dog? Did you get that thing I asked you to do? It can easily affect, well, why are you telling me what to do? Why are you going after me? Well, really all you're asking is, did the dog get a walk? And so you can feel very accusatory, even if we don't mean it that way. And so we need to be careful about when and how we use that word.
I see. So kind of like a rule of thumb is, like the walk the dog example is interesting because there might be a set rule in a household. You need to walk the dog every day. And when you say, did you walk the dog? It could be a little bit accusatory because it's like breaking the rules of the household. Just like, did you mess up your iPhone again? Like now we have to tell you how to turn it. It's a little bit more accusatory. If it somehow feels even slightly accusatory, don't do it. But, you know, here's what I'm wondering though. It feels like there's a third category. So there's this kind of impersonal third person, which is like, here's how to turn on the iPhone. Then there's the you, which in many cases, if it's relatable, like here's five tips how you could be a better speaker, or here's five tips on how you could blah, blah, blah. Then it's like helpful. And let's say it's something everybody who wants to be a better speaker or a better whatever will relate to it because they'll feel themselves in the you. But there's a third category, which works very well, I think, for viral. And I'm curious if you've looked at it, which is to use the word I. Like, I went from being a poor speaker to a better speaker. Here's five ways I did it. And people very much, they want to hear another person's story because it's like a free way they can ride my emotional roller coaster.
Yeah. Well, I'd say a few things. So first, you definitely hold attention, but you can also do other things. If, you know, in an online review, I say, oh my God, you're going to love this product. Sometimes people feel a little bit of reactance. They say, well, you know, how do you know what I'm going to like? How can you assume what I'm going to think? It feels like you're telling me what to think. And so I don't like it, but I certainly agree beyond you, right? You is just one word. It's a type of second person pronoun. I is also a different word that has differing impacts, right? I can feel more personal. There's some nice research that shows in a customer service context. When service agents talk about, I will solve your problem rather than you know, this is what we're going to do to solve your problem. People believe more that they're actually going to do something about the problem, right? Because they're taking ownership for what's going on. They're not just saying, you know, we as this colossal company are going to say, but I'm going to do this for you. It makes people feel like that person actually has the agency to take care of it. And so by no means am I saying, you know, the only word we should care about is you. This is just one small section of one small chapter of the book. But it's interesting to think about how these subtle shifts in language can have such a big impact.
Yeah, like thinking about it in a couple of contexts, like let's say you're on a date and you're very excited about the date. If the person you're on the date with keeps saying, oh, I like these people or I like this movie, that could feel a little narcissistic. If they say to me, oh, you would love these other people or they would love you, then it's like the person's including me in like her tribe.
Yep.
And so then it's inclusive. But I guess you would use I when you could use you, but there's a danger of being accusatory or insulting. And so I kind of takes the responsibility first and lets you decide if you're going to ride my roller coaster or not.
Yeah. And even like, take something.
If I went up to you, let's say I was your boss and I went up to you in your cubicle and I said, Jonah, did you shit in your pants again today? You might be insulted. But if I say, listen, every once in a while, I shit in my pants during the day. Here's what I do to solve it. If you need this information, go help yourself.
So I don't know where to begin my answer here, but I think what I would say is, you know, similar to the language you were talking about on the date, first, we do actually find in conversation that conversations last longer when we don't just talk about ourselves, but people use words like you, right? It brings in the audience. But when making recommendations, you can be a little bit dangerous and can evoke reactance. And so rather than saying, you know, you'd love these people, something like these people are great, right? It indicates that, you know, I have a certain attitude towards these people, but I'm not being prescriptive or telling you how to feel about it.
I mean, a lot of these techniques, and yes, the you word is only one. There's a billion chapters in the book. We're going to get to them. But a lot of the techniques in the book are kind of related to in-group, out-group bias and how much you want to create an in-group with the people you're talking to, or how much you have to be careful about being out-group. So for instance, you mentioned comedy as an example, and that's related to one of the final chapters in the book about similarity. Like, you, it's always good in conversation to point out similarities, and people relate to that. Like, there's studies that show even if you and I had the same initials, we're kind of more inclined to be kind to each other than if we had different initials, which is a weird result. But you know, in comedy, you always want to, when you're doing crowd work, when the comedian's talking to the crowd, you're always trying to find similarities, because then if they're in the same tribe as you, they're more likely to laugh at your later jokes. And I think this works really well in negotiation and conversation, and you point this out as well. But this you versus not you is also a matter of deciding how much you want to include the reader in your tribe. When it's you, it's like kind of assuming you're in the same tribe. When it's more third person, that maybe is better to use when, hey, I'm in the tribe of the authority and you're in the tribe of people who might need help from authority. So, you know, when you're trying to create distance, authority versus non-authority.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree that some of the things relate to similarity and in-group, out-group. And I myself have done a bunch of research on those type of things. I wouldn't say, though, most of the book relates to that, right? So there's content, for example, on how asking people to be a helper rather than help makes them more likely to do what you ask them to do. And that certainly...
Oh, that was fascinating, actually. Can you describe that one?
Okay, sure. So... one of the chapters is about agency and identity, the language of agency and identity. And so language not only sort of provides information, but it suggests who we're talking to or what identities they might hold. And often as individuals, you know, we're trying to get someone else to do something. We might ask someone to help us out, help us do something. Or if we're a nonprofit, we might ask for something as well. We might say, hey, you know, can you turn out to vote? Please help us and go vote. And we often use verbs like help or vote to encourage people to do something, but it turns out a small difference, a very subtle difference in language can have a big impact. They did a study, for example, many years ago, where they asked kids to help clean up. It's a mess in a classroom, and they said, hey, you know, please help clean up. And for some students, they said exactly that, please help clean up. But for other students, they said, hey, please be a helper and clean up. Now, help and helper are almost identical, right? One just adds ER on the other end. And so you would think, well, not going to matter, but it had actually a 30% increase in the percentage of students that helped. And you could say, well, maybe that's just, you know, kids and classrooms. How does this really matter? Well, there's another study that was done more recently where they mailed thousands of voters requests to vote. So sort of a get out the vote type initiative. And for some people, they said, hey, you know, please vote. And for other people, they said, hey, please be a voter. Again, infinitesimally small difference, right? Vote versus voter, one just adds an R on the end of what's already there. But they found that led to about a 15% increase in the percentage of people that turned out. And the reason why is pretty simple, which is that we can use language to describe characteristics or actions, or we can use language to describe identities. So I could tell you that I have a friend who runs, for example, or I could tell you I have a friend who is a runner. If you had to guess, if I said they run versus they are a runner, in which case do you think they run more? If I said they run or I said they are a runner?
Probably a runner, because I'm thinking the person does it every day, so he's good at it.
It's a stable trait, right? That's a case where you turn an action, running, into an identity, being a runner. And it turns out that when we use identities, nouns, to describe people, they're a dog lover rather than they love dogs. They're a runner rather than they run. Those aspects seem more lasting. Right? It's not just something they do, it's something they are, and so that thing will be more persistent. But what that means is by taking actions, like running, like helping, like voting, and turning them into identities, like being a runner, being a helper, being a voter, as long as those identities are desirable, we can motivate people to do what we wanted them to do by turning them into actions. So people say, oh, voting is great, but wait, this is an opportunity to be a voter? Now I'm more likely to do it because I want to claim that desired identity.
Right. And again, and maybe I'm trying to turn everything into a nail with this hammer, but it's like when you say someone's a voter rather than, hey, are you going to vote or please vote? You're putting them in a tribe and they're identifying. If they get your letter and say, yeah, I'm a voter, they're putting themselves in the tribe. So now they have to act like a tribe member acts. They don't have to say, well, this person's asking me to do something I may or may not do. They're first identifying with some, you know, identity you're giving them, and then their brain is doing the rest of the work.
Yeah, do I want to hold this identity? And if so, I want to take the action. And what you're right about is because it's about identity, right? If it's about a negative identity, the opposite happens. So, if I said which is worse, losing or being a loser, you said, oh my God, being a loser is much worse. And it's a stable trait. Same, you know, which is worse, cheating or being a cheater? Well, being a cheater is much worse. And so research actually finds that, you know, in a classroom setting, if you're trying to get people not to cheat, rather than tell them, well, don't cheat, telling them don't be a cheater, right? When cheating is now a thing that indicates that I'm a cheater, I'm now much less likely to do it because I don't want to hold that undesirable identity. And so I think this is neat in a number of ways, right? One, we can use it to sort of influence or persuade others, but we can also use it to make ourselves portrayed as one way or another. If we're writing a resume, for example, you know, rather than saying we're hardworking, saying we're a hard worker will suggest that trait is more long-lasting and more general. Rather than saying, you know, we're creative or we're innovative, saying we're a creator or we're an innovator will suggest those things are likely to last and stick around. So same thing with motivating teams, right? Rather than saying, hey, you know, I want you to lead more, say be a leader, right? As long as it's desirable, people will be more likely to take that action.
You know, during this whole pandemic and lockdown, it really became clear, at least to me, how important mental health is. Like, it's so easy. Like, we more or less, I feel like, take care of other types of health. Like, we don't want to feel bad physically. But sometimes when you feel bad mentally, there are things you can do to lift yourself. I remember I was having one podcast a long time ago, not the recent podcast with Stephen Kotler, but a long time ago, where he said, you know, everybody's got this baseline of happiness, and the one way to increase that baseline is through meditation, which is why I'm really grateful to the sponsor Headspace for sponsoring this episode. Headspace helps improve mental health through guided meditations, mindfulness practices, breathing, calming exercises, and so much more. Headspace uses scientifically proven benefits of meditation and mindfulness with modern practices through their experienced meditation teachers. So wide range of teachers, all different kinds of meditation. There are all the different areas of expertise. Ensure there's a teacher and content to help you, whether you're a first timer or have been practicing for years. They have the largest library of content with over 1,000 hours of clinically proven mental health exercises. So like, for instance, even as a kid and young adult, I was into meditation a little bit. But lately I find when I try to do it, I've been having trouble focusing on meditation. And so I'm grateful for a product like Headspace because they give guided meditations and it sort of reminds me what meditation is. Look, that was really important to me. I think it's important to a lot of people. Headspace has helped more than 100 million people worldwide. They can help you as well. So listen up. You do not want to miss this. For a limited time, all of you can try Headspace free, totally free. And I highly recommend it. You can try Headspace for free for the next 30 days by going to headspace.com /Altucher. You won't find this offer on any other podcast. It's just me. So you must use my link, HEADSPACE.com/Altucher, to unlock all of Headspace free for 30 days. Headspace.com/Altucher. So let me ask a question. Have you used these techniques, like for instance, with your students in the classroom or in organizations that you've spoken with? This technique in particular, let's say you were motivating, or let's say you were telling your students not to cheat. Have you found personal success with this particular technique?
You know, there are so many different techniques in the book. I think right now we're talking about the first chapter, and the first chapter alone, there are probably 5 different buckets of approaches that people can use to increase their impact. I've used the help be a helper with my kids and have certainly seen that to work better, yes.
That's so interesting. I can't recall if I've ever tried that with my kids. Kids are a great laboratory.
They are a great laboratory, yes.
What I've used with my kids that has worked is saying something like, instead of saying, you shouldn't do this, I say something like, I'm disappointed that this happened. And then they feel really bad that they disappointed me.
Yes. So I hear you. There is some work, though, that shows that the danger of doing that is now they're not doing the thing, not because they think it's bad, but because they don't want to disappoint you. And so I think one of the great challenges of being a parent is, in some sense, you want to instill someone with a value system without telling them what to do, right? You want to figure out a way to have them come to that conclusion on their own without being told to do it. Because if they're doing it because you told them, well, now when you're gone, if you say, don't eat junk food because it'll be bad for you. And they say, okay, I'm not doing this because dad told me to. Well, now when dad's not around, I don't have to do it anymore. Whereas I decide that junk food's not so good. If I come to that place on my own, then I'm much less likely to do it even when no one's around. So the challenge I find with being a parent as well is how you instill that value system without being too pushy.
That's great. So like, for instance, let's say you want them to eat healthy foods. You could say, look, unhealthy people have miserable lives and die younger. And if you eat this junk food, you'll be an unhealthy person, as opposed to saying, don't eat this food because it's unhealthy.
Well, or saying, hey, how does this make you feel? Right? Like, yes, it's maybe delicious now, but how does your stomach feel later? Do you feel like you have a lot of energy? Do you feel good? And not telling them what to think, but encouraging them to realize, well, does this make me feel good or not? And if it doesn't necessarily make them feel good, they've come to that conclusion on their own.
This works even, I mean, you have some discussion in the book about self-talk. This works even when you're talking to yourself, like the loser example. Like, do I describe myself as losing this one thing, or like, let's say you lose a deal, I lost a deal, or do you describe yourself as a loser? It could be kind of, do you find that self-talk is persuasive, or is the mind strong enough to recognize bullshit when it hears it?
You know, there's some great work on self-talk that I talk about in the book, and it's really about kind of, you know, how to help us deal with anxiety. Often we're in a situation, we're about to give a presentation, and it's a big, important presentation, or, you know, we're turning something in, and it feels like a lot of pressure. And so we may feel very, very anxious, and obviously anxiety doesn't necessarily help us perform at our best. What I think is so interesting in those type of situations, though, is if it wasn't us, if it was a friend who was dealing with it, you know, we'd know what we'd say. We'd say, you know, you can do it, do a great job. You know, as an outsider, we can really help them and coach them, but we can't do that so much for ourselves. But there's some really nice research that says, hey, actually, if we distance ourselves from the situation a little bit, you know, rather than saying, you know, how do I feel about this? But, you know, using our name, you know, you can do it, Jonah, or distancing ourselves a little bit from the situation, using self-talk can actually be a great way to overcome our anxiety, right? Because we're so anxious to it because we're so close. But by using language that makes us feel a little bit further away, a little bit more distant, almost like we would coach another person, it can help us remove that anxiety and perform better.
So distancing, plus I think this concept of identity versus action would be great to use. Like, you know, instead of saying, I'm a winner, I could say, you know, come on, you're a winner, or James is a winner. And then you could distance further, like people like James are winners. And I wonder, you know, there's levels of distancing. Like, how do you know what's the right level of distancing to do? And should you include this idea of action versus identity in the self-talk?
I don't know if I would necessarily mix those two things, but distance is certainly something that can be helpful when something is aversive, but it's not just that, right? So even take something as simple as what we should do in a given situation. We're often trying to solve a tough problem. We're often trying to be creative. We often kind of think about what should we do in that situation. Some nice research shows that if we actually think about what we could do, so changing the word should with the word could, that helps us think a little bit more creatively because it helps us think beyond the situation we're in, right? What I should do really thinks about kind of rules and right answers and keeps us pretty close or nearby to what we're thinking about. If instead we think about what we could do, well, I mean, I could do a million things. Now, maybe not all of them are good ideas, but by thinking about what I could do, it actually helps us get to more creative solutions and become better problem solvers. And so even in something like being creative or solving problems, subtle shifts in language can have a big impact.
Yeah, you know, I was fascinated too by the chapter on should versus could. You know, and it seems very useful in business because I think of someone like Richard Branson, who he started hundreds of companies. And his very first company, of course, was like this little music magazine. So he could have, in his brain, he could have said to himself, I'm a music guy, I'm a magazine guy, that's my business, that's my field. But, and so when presented with an opportunity, he could say, well, I shouldn't do that, I'm just a music guy, I'm not an airline guy. And so instead of saying, I should be a music guy, he says, well, I could also be an airline guy. I'm wondering if you know, like, there's always the research shows something, but and it's, you know, supports the claims. But I wonder if you could think of like real life examples in, you know, famous examples where it was really obvious they were using could instead of should to describe their decision making.
Yeah, I mean, so this is why we analyze data in the field, right? So I haven't interviewed Richard Branson, so I can't speak to exactly what he did in his own personal life. But, you know, in another study where we were interested in kind of the language that makes movies more successful, we analyzed thousands, tens of thousands of movies. Or similarly for songs, you know, we did some work showing what language makes songs more successful. And so it's not just about one example. What I love about research is kind of, you know, any one example can be right or wrong, right? Richard Branson might do something or he might not do something. But just because he did it doesn't mean that thing led him to be successful, right? There may be 10,000 people who did that same thing and failed. But the nice thing about research is at looking across thousands of examples and doing rigorous statistical analysis, we can say, okay, you know, did this thing lead to an impact? It doesn't mean that every single time, you know, something is hugely successful every time you use this thing, but on average, it moves the needle in the right direction. And I think, you know, that's what I find so fascinating about language. Sometimes we think, oh, you know, so-and-so is so charismatic. Whenever they get up and they give a speech, everyone's just like, wow, their speech is amazing. Or, you know, so-and-so is such a good writer. I wish I could be a good writer, you know, but I wasn't, I'm not a good writer. And we treat it very much like it's something you're born with or you're not, but it's not fixed, right? If we understand how to use language, we can all be better speakers. We can all be more impactful writers if we understand the power of magic words.
Again, this should, could thing, it reminds me of the differences between, you know, deliberate practice in the so-called 10,000 hour rule, the idea that you have to practice the same thing over and over, get coaching, did you do it right, fix what you did wrong, and then do it again or repeat. And do that for 10,000 hours and you'll be the best violinist in the world. Versus, so that should, oh, I should move my arm this way, I should play the chord this way. But could probably work, is more like deliberate play, like, well, some people do it this way, but I'm going to try this way and I'm going to improv a little bit. It's like almost the difference between like a classical violinist versus a jazz pianist. So could has a little bit more improv to it and, you know, should has a little bit more deliberate practice to it.
Could certainly helps us think more broadly, right? It's not about, and by the way, that doesn't mean we implement what we could do, right? A lot of the things we could do would be terrible ideas. Just because we could do it doesn't mean it's a good idea. But I think by thinking about what we could do, we get beyond the narrow set of associations that we're thinking about at the moment. And by thinking about a diverse set of things, it can help us come up with a better solution. You know, I've worked with a bunch of companies and organizations around things related to ideation or coming up with solutions. And often, by thinking of an analogous situation, it's not the same situation we're in. By helping you think outside of that narrow situation, you know, it can help us think more broadly. Sometimes a company will have me come in and they'll say, oh, you know, we only want examples for you to talk about that relate to our industry. And I usually push back a little bit. I say, look, if you just want to know about things that people in your industry have already done, that's fine. But if you want to look how to sort of get ahead and move your industry forward, it would make sense to look beyond your industry, not because you have to do exactly what they did, but by seeing what they did, it can help us think about what's possible, which may then help us reframe what we're setting out to do in a way that leads us to a better solution.
Yeah, I thought that discussion was so fascinating. Similarly, and this is kind of, you know, some of the stuff you talk about is about external influence. I'm talking to someone else and I would like to elicit some behavior from them. But some of them is about internal, how you focus on things internally could help you think about it. So catching yourself saying should instead of could, or could instead of should in some cases, will affect your own personal decision making. But you have to be aware of how, you know, when it comes up that you're, oh, I'm using should in this case, but maybe I should try could. Another, a similar one is when you're talking about saying no to people, the difference between can't and don't.
Yeah.
So if someone asks you to go to a dinner and it's late at night, you could say, I can't, you know, my boss needs me in the office early in the morning, blah, blah, blah. Or you could say, oh, I don't stay up past 9 p.m. It's been a discipline of mine forever. And so, but then it's like you have this credo that you're just following. You're, and people respect that. You're sticking by your personal set of values. And so that's why you have to say no to their offer. And I thought that discussion was very interesting.
Yeah. So again, can't and don't are very, very similar, right? You could say, well, why does it matter whether we say one of those versus the other? But as you talked about a little bit, you know, can't suggests the locus of control or the agency is external. I can't do something because something else is holding me back, right? I can't go out to dinner because I, you know, my boss, I need to deliver something early tomorrow morning. Or, you know, I can't, you know, there's delicious cake. I can't eat this cake because I'm on a diet. It makes it seem like the locus of control is external. Something's preventing me from doing something. Whereas don't is a little more internal. You know, it's not that I can't go out late, but I don't go out late, right? I'm the one that decided it. It's not that I can't eat chocolate cake, but that I don't eat chocolate cake. Nothing external. There's no external thing preventing me. It's a personal choice. And so whether I want to use can't or don't depends a little bit on the situation. There's some research on goals and achieving the goals that we want to achieve, whether it's getting in better shape, whether it's, you know, spending less time on social media, whatever it is, there are always temptations that are come across the way. But research finds that if we say, you know, I don't do something, it makes us more likely to stick with our goals because it makes us feel like we are in control. It's not that I can't do something because, you know, my diet wouldn't let me, but I really want to eat that cake. If I said I don't eat chocolate cake, that's something I chose. I'm more in control of my choices, and so I'm more likely to stick with it. At the same time, though, if we're looking for an out, right? If we're looking, I don't want to go out to dinner late. You know, I at work, I don't want to take on this extra project. There, it's a situation where we want to make it seem like it's external. It's not that I don't want to take on this project, but I can't take on this project because this other person asked me to do this, right? I can't do it because there's already a meeting scheduled at that time. I want to help, but this external thing is preventing me from doing it. And what I like about that sort of external kind of nobody is has two benefits. First, now people can't blame you as much. But second, if you would be happy to go to that meeting or do that thing as long as this external thing was resolved, now you've given that person who asked you for the request an opportunity to resolve that thing. If your boss says, hey, can you do XYZ? And you say, oh, I can't. I already promised this person something. Well, they can come back and say, great, I talked to them and you don't need to do that anymore. Well, now you're happy to do the thing they asked you for. You just couldn't do both of the things at once. And so it gives somebody else a more clear signal about what you need to be able to do what they want.
Why do you think it's more personally pleasing to say, I'm not the type of person who does X. I don't do X. Somehow there's something pleasing and authentic about saying, I don't do whatever, so that you take responsibility. I'm not saying it's bad to say I can't, because sometimes you don't want, I can't go to your wedding because I have this other thing. Sometimes it's better to put the blame somewhere else, but it's also nice to say, I just don't go to weddings in Hawaii. I don't feel like taking the plane ride for 9 hours. So why do you think that the closer you place the onus on yourself, sometimes that is pleasing?
Well, let's be careful. Pleasing to whom? Right? So it's certainly pleasing to the self, right? If I say, I don't do this, it makes you feel like you have principles, right? I don't go to weddings that are more than 8 hours away. You know, I never eat after 8 p.m., right? It's pleasing to us because it makes us feel like we are a principled person. We have rules that guide our life and we live by this credo. I would be careful, though, of telling that friend, well, I don't go to weddings in Hawaii because I don't take flights that are longer than 9 hours. They'd say, well, why is it about how long the flight is? Isn't it how much our friendship is worth? And so I'd be a little bit careful at telling other people that we don't do things, but I agree it can make us feel good.
I agree. And look, I've said I can't do X because of someone else a million times. Like, I'm more than happy to put the blame elsewhere as much as I can. But your book is such a great basket of tools. And again, a lot of it depends on context and situation, which tool you use and how you use it, and which you use can't versus don't, you should versus could. You could use all of these things. It just depends on context and situation. And you describe that, the pros and cons of each word in the book. One technique which I have found personally incredibly useful, which you describe in the book, is asking advice. This is like an unbelievably powerful technique. And so can you describe that one?
Yeah. I think many of us, if not all of us, have this intuition that asking for advice is a bad idea for a couple reasons, right? So whether we're dealing with a tough problem at work, whether we're having an issue in our personal lives, whatever it might be, we feel like asking for advice will be a burden on somebody else. Maybe they're busy. Who knows if they'll be able to help. Or even worse, it'll make us look bad, right? Like if I'm at work and, you know, I ask somebody for advice about how to do something, it makes it seem like I don't know how to do that thing. And so we often just say, well, I'll skip it, right? I don't want to look bad. I don't want to look incompetent. I want to look, non-knowledgeable. And so I won't ask for advice. But a good bit of research actually finds that the opposite is true. So they did an experiment, for example, whether they had people interact with someone else who they thought was a partner. It was actually a research assistant on a task. And as part of that task, the other person in the interaction either asked someone for advice or did not, right? So some people had a partner that asked them for advice, and some people had a partner who didn't. And what they found is when you thought your partner asked you for advice, well, you thought much more favorably of them. Not only did you think they were smarter and more competent, but you liked them more. And you might say, well, why is that, right? Why would asking for advice make us look smarter, not less smart? And part of the reason, very simply, is, well, people like thinking their advice is good, right? Most people think, I give good advice, I'm a smart person. And so if somebody else is smart enough to ask me for advice, well, they must be a smart person because they know I'm a good person to ask. So by making the advice giver feel good about themselves and building on that feeling they have that they know what they're talking about, it actually can make us look good as a result.
You know, I think there's one thing I would add to that is that when you ask someone for advice, you're giving them status. Like you're giving them a small injection, yes, of status. You know, that triggers all sorts of dopamine or serotonin or whatever it is. They like that feeling.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good feeling. And you're giving them that feeling by asking for advice.
You think I'm knowledgeable enough to be worth asking, right? It makes me feel like you think of, right, me favorably, which makes me feel good. Yeah.
And like, I'm just curious, again, this is such a valuable technique. Have you used it for, let's say you're negotiating a consulting agreement. Have you, you could say to the company you're doing the agreement with, hey, I'm just a professor. You're the expert on hiring consultants. Can I ask your advice? If you were me, what would you charge?
Yeah. You know, I use a related approach that I talk a little bit about in this book and also a little bit in my last book, The Catalyst, which is rather than saying, I want this, I'm saying, hey, which of these two things do you think is better? So you're not only asking them for advice, you're kind of asking them, which one they think is a better fit. And often because you've asked them, they feel like they're in the driver's seat, right? They don't feel like you're forcing them to do something. You feel like you've asked, they've been asked for their opinion. They think about which one they like better and they end up being much more likely to go along. And so I think questions can be really powerful. You know, there's a whole chapter on questions in the book. And I think often we think, well, questions are just about collecting information, but questions do a lot more than that, right? They shape what other people think about us, whether they like us or not. You know, asking certain types of questions, like follow-up questions, make us seem responsive, which make people like us more. Even the right questions can be used to deepen social connection. And so questions can be really powerful if we use them the right way.
And by the way, you're right. Like, I've neglected that section up till now. That is like, that section on questions is going to be my Bible for social interaction now. Like, I needed that chapter more than anything else. Like, from anything from meeting people to how to ask questions to the ideas behind asking follow-up questions, that is such a valuable section. Another section, and I know we're pressed for time, so I'll ask about this. You talk about how definitive one should be. So for instance, better, particularly for content, better to be definitive as opposed to hedging. And I agree, as a writer of many books myself and many blog posts that have gone viral, for better or for worse, definitives go viral, hedges don't. And I've seen this over and over again, and I've given this advice, but describe a little bit what you mean and what you
What we're talking about here is the language of certainty or confidence. And one reason we think that certain people are more charismatic, or one reason that we listen to some people more, is they just seem so certain, right? I love seeing this with politicians or sort of gurus or startup founders. You know, you hear them talk and you go, if you look at the content of what they're saying, you go, why are people following this person? What they're saying doesn't make any sense. But if you look at the way they're saying what they're saying, they often speak with a great deal of certainty. They often speak like something is obvious or must be true, and anyone who thought otherwise would be crazy. And so it's hard not to, because they're so certain, because they seem so confident, it's hard not to be persuaded. And so research shows, for example, that in a financial advising capacity, people are more likely to choose confident financial advisors, even if they're advice is no better, because they go, wow, this person seems like they know what they're talking about. And so hedges are one example of this. We often say something, and I hesitate here because if we looked at the transcript of this interview, I probably hedged a bunch. But people often say things like, I think this, or this may be true, or possibly that, or, you know, this seems this way to me. And while we do this because it's easy to sort of couch our language in one thing or another, it often undermines our impact. We've done a bunch of research in the context of hedges that shows that hedging makes us less persuasive because it makes us seem like we're less confident or certain about what we're talking about. And if we seem more certain, if we don't even know what we're talking about, why should anybody listen, right? Why should they follow us? But what I will say, though, is certain hedges are actually more persuasive than others. So there's a difference, for example, if I said, this seems good versus this seems good to me, right? One is a general hedge, this seems good. The other is this seems good to me, suggesting in my own opinion, this seems good. And what we find is that actually reduces some of the hurt of hedges. And the reason why is people are willing to attach themselves to something, right? If this person's willing to say, this is how I feel, then where they seem more certain, and so we're more likely to be persuaded.
Well, Jonah Berger, author of Magic Words, Contagious, and The Catalyst, and so many other great books that we've spoken about, this book really is such a great guide to so many critical aspects of life, like how to best say no, how to have social interactions, how to influence people, how to make content go viral, and so many other, how to ask questions, so many other things. I can't recommend this enough. I've been taking notes. I've got half the book pages folded over. Thank you for writing this. Maybe you'll come back on again. I'm sure I'm going to have even more questions. So maybe we can schedule another time when you come on and we could keep talking about it. But thank you so much for coming on the show once again. And the book is Magic Words. What day is it released?
March 7th.
March 7th. Okay, great. Well, great book. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it.